Okay, Senate Resources is called to order. It's February the 18th, and the time is 3:35. Present for the record, we do have a quorum to conduct business consisting of Senator Huggins, Senator Stevens, Senator Wilikowski, Senator French, and a big warm welcome back to Senator Wagner.
Thank you.
We're really happy that you're here and healthy and joining us today. We have the subject of cold climate research on the agenda today, and we're delighted to have the director with us. But before we get to that, for a brief 15-minute snapshot is Ken Bauer, who's with Siemens Building Technology. It's just one of the companies out there that's looking at energy and environmental solutions. And we thought it was appropriate because some of the recommendations that come directly out of the cold climate housing report would entail modifications to our structures that we have in Alaska, and this is one of the companies out there that has a creative business approach to addressing that. So with that, we'll hear from Ken Bauer. Ken, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you. Do you have the slide presentation?
We do. The members have it in front of them.
Okay, great. Okay. Basically, I'll just go through this real quick and do an overview of performance contracting and how it's been greatly increased the effects of energy performance. Your first slide just basically is the definition. Performance contracting is a vehicle that allows public and private entities to improve their facilities by using their energy and operational budgets to fund a project. Slide two, under performance contracting overview, a ESCO energy services company provides a preliminary building audit report. This is called benchmarking, where we go out, take a look at the facility, we look at the different items you have in there, and then provide a preliminary report that gives the customer an idea of where they stand among buildings of this type throughout the USA as far as energy efficiency. This audit is reviewed at the customer, and a letter of intent for a detailed audit, you know, would be the next step. During the detailed audit, which is also called a financial grade audit, an engineer goes out to the facility, spends some time out there, identifies the FIMS, which is the facility improvement measures, and the cost and savings associated with each. These FIMS are reviewed with the customer, the scope of the project is defined. We also talk about projects that may be involved in the building but may not be necessarily energy savings, such as health and safety, fire systems, security systems, something that might be of interest to the building manager. See if something like that can be included in the project. If the customer is agreeable to that, the performance contract is signed, the project is implemented, and turned over to the customer. There is an ongoing measurement and verification program after the program is done to confirm these savings. The next slide, the audit process, this just basically goes into detail and shows the different types of the workflow that we go through to develop this program, and how we work in conjunction with the customer, and that it's a partnership where we try to develop the best plan for that customer. And the basic workflow is going to be the same for each, although the FIMS, the facility improvement measures, are going to vary depending upon the individual one. But we try to set it up so that we achieve maximum efficiency for that particular building, depending upon their particular need. The next slide is the PC process. How the program works is the finance is arranged through a third party or directly from the customer, and your energy project is implemented, and the savings generated repay the financing. And you've got three types of savings. You've got your energy savings, which is the amount of energy you're going to save because the measures we're going to do are going to lower your gas usage, your fuel oil usage, your electrical usage, possibly your water usage. The operational savings would be as far as just the man work hours. If you can streamline the process, you can lower the man hours in the operations. And then, of course, the maintenance savings. I think the best example would be in lighting. whereas the new T8 bulbs and T5 bulbs and all the compact fluorescents have a 2 to 3 times longer life. Some of the leads in certain applications are even longer than that, and that allows for the maintenance. Instead of having someone changing the bulbs every 3 or 4 months, you may not be changing those bulbs for, you know, a year to 2 years. So you've got savings there. Siemens or Anyesco would guarantee that the savings exceed the cost of financing. Otherwise, they pay the difference. And like I said before, the ongoing measurement and verification program will continue to confirm that savings. And this is a mutual agreed upon program, which would be, in some cases, they do it for 2 years, sometimes as long as 5, to determine that the savings are done. That would be a feature that would be pretty much mutually agreed upon by the two parties involved. The next slide, like I said, the funding comes from the operational and capital budgets. We've guaranteed funding available from third-party sources if necessary. We can help arrange for competitive bid financing from multiple sources. And of course, the energy and operational savings are guaranteed to offset the cost of the loan payments. The guarantee, on the next slide, how the guarantee works is the project has a guaranteed fixed price. There is a no or change order policy for the given scope of work. The energy savings are guaranteed. And like I said, if we don't, if the energy savings aren't met, then the ESCO company will issue the customer check in the amount of the difference, and or they will implement additional facility improvement measures to meet that energy guarantee at Siemens or the ESCO's cost. And there again, like I said, the ongoing measurement verification program ensures that this happens. The next page, project execution process, is just an overview of the project as you get into it, and there again shows all the different steps and the detailed steps to ensure that the project is a good project, that everything goes according to plan, and the customer receives the most positive energy savings that can be developed. The next slide, some typical facility improvement measures, and these are some of the things we did. We are currently finishing up phase two of a project with the state of Alaska. We did 8 buildings in phase one with the Department of Administration. Those 8 buildings are, we did the Diamond Courthouse down in Juneau, the Alaska Office Building in Juneau, the Court Plaza Building, also in Juneau, the Douglas Island Building, and the State Office Building, both for Juneau. We did the Aviation Building here in Anchorage, the DOT Annex Building in Anchorage, and the Public Safety Building in Anchorage. And we did a variety of these facility improvement measures for that. We're also in the process of finishing up on a project with the Department of Corrections, where we did 8 different correctional facilities around the state. The Anchorage Correctional Center in Anchorage, the Highland Mountain in Eagle River, Spring Creek in Seward, Wildwood in Kenai, Fairbanks Correctional Center in Fairbanks, the Lemon Creek down in Juneau, the Yukon Kuskokwim in Bethel, and the Mount Anvil Correctional Center in Nome. Some of these typical improvement measures, either one or all of these were done in different facilities, the lighting, upgrading the lighting to the most current lightings, LED exit signs, water, low flow fixtures were put in to minimize the flow, hot water, temperatures and regeneration. One thing we did do, which I found exciting, is we, in the one prison, we installed a ozone generating machine. What that does, injecting ozone into the water, it allows the detergent to work with colder water, so you don't have to use all hot water to do your wash. And you get the same results, but you lower your energy costs by not having to use as much hot water.
Interesting.
The heating cooling systems, all your pumps, your frequency drives, et cetera, outside air with your quantity and heat recovery, of course, process lab loads. Don't think we got into any of that on these projects, but that's one of the things that could be done. And then retro commissioning is a process where sometimes the building doesn't really need a lot of upgrades, but it hasn't been fine-tuned. And it's just a matter of going back and making sure that all the systems that are there are working in harmony with each other. And sometimes a little tinker here, a little tinker there by maintenance people pretty soon are not working in harmony. You don't get the best results. And of course, build and shell as far as making sure proper insulation, windows, etc. One other item we like to throw out there is alternative energy, which especially in the bush areas, I think is important. When you go in and start doing retrofits of buildings, you could also consider alternative energy project in conjunction with that. Biomass, geothermal, digester, or landfill gas, or wind, where you can supplement the supply side of the energy so that you may be reducing it on the use side, but then supplementing on the supply side with all the high cost of fuel oil and also transportation out there. I think this is a very important part of any type of project on that. And then the final, basically the final steps, that's where we go when once we decide which buildings to do and present the audit to the customer and let them make a decision. That's in a nutshell is what performance contracting is and what we can do. And I know there are several other ESCO companies out there that are available to do the same thing. And I guess I would entertain questions.
Great. Thank you very much, Ken. We appreciate it. Questions from the committee. Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So just to kind of boil this down, in terms of the fiscal cost, does the state or municipality or whoever's using your services have to make any outlying financial? Do they have to pay you essentially to do this? I mean, how does this work in a nutshell? Is it my understanding? Go ahead.
Well, say for instance, we go out and we see a project, and the project's going to cost $1 million to do. For the course of that project, we find that we can save you $100,000 each year on that project. So basically, without any finance cost, that's going to take 10 years out of that cost to pay back on there. Now, there's an upfront cost for the detailed audit, which would be rolled into that, plus your financing cost. So for sake of argument, let's just say that your final cost is around $12 million. So basically, you've got a $12 million note out there that has to be paid off. The payments would be tailored so that, a $1.2 million project out there. And the payments would be tailored then so that each year you would pay $100,000 on this note, which would be the savings that you're realizing. Your electric bills, your gas bills, your water bills are going to be $100,000 lower than what you had before. So we would look and make sure, and we're not going to guarantee dollars, although it'll start out as dollars at first. We're going to guarantee consumption because, as you well know, the prices are going to increase and the prices are going to go up. But we're going to guarantee that consumption based on today's prices are going to continue with that. So you're going to save that $100,000 on your operating budget, but then again, you're going to be able to take that and make a loan payment, to either Siemens or the financial institution that financed the project for that. Now, if the entity has like a grant or some money to put down, of course, then this shortens the term and makes the project term a little bit shorter and, of course, saves money on, on interest. Does that explain it?
It does. And I'm sure the finance members on the committee will appreciate the essentially zero fiscal note. And so just on the projects that you've done for the state, how long has it taken for the state to recoup? If you could give us maybe a couple examples.
The first project, DOT, that was written up, that was the term of contract is 12 years on it, is what they're expecting. They're saving about, it was a little over $250,000 a year. The project investment was a little over $4 million. However, when they did the measurement verification, the project actually came in 24% better than we originally planned. So the last figure I saw is that it's probably going to pay off, you know, in about 8.5, you know, a little under 9 years on the project on that. The DOC, I don't have the figures on that yet. Originally, it was a 15-year payback. It was a little higher savings because there was some more work there, and there was about $750,000 per year savings projected on that. But we're just starting the measurement and verification process on that, so I don't have any firm figures on that. But normally, we do not look, we don't suggest projects, but kind of a ballpark figure is 15 years. If we can't get a project under 15 years, then we don't feel it's a good thing for the customer.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And as you track those figures, our resources committee would be interested in receiving any of that data. It's
okay.
It's exciting. Thank you. Okay. And so next we have former Representative John Davies, who's the research director of the Cold Climate Housing Research Center. And he is accompanied by Katie Lister, who's a senior consultant from Information Insights. And they've got a PowerPoint for us today. Welcome. It's good to see you. Is it good to be back in the building?
Yes, it is. Thank you very much for having us down here.
Hi, I'm Katie Lister. I'm obviously not John Davies. I'm with Information Insights. I'm a senior consultant there and was one of the principal authors of the Alaska Energy Efficiency Program and Policy Recommendations. So this, I'm going to do the first part of the presentation, which is basically just kind of going over our methodology for the project and what our recommendations were at the time. It's worth noting that the price of fuel at the time that this report was written was significantly higher than it is right now, and sort of it was a different climate. And then I'll turn it over to John, who will talk more about kind of what recommendations make sense right now given the current economic and political climate. So that's how it's going to go.
Right.
The first slide is just basically, you know, energy efficiency. Why focus on energy efficiency? And the answer is that we can do it now. We don't have to wait for anything. There's voluminous research and data to back up energy efficiency measures that have been implemented all over the country and all over the world. Efficiency relies on advances in technology, which are becoming more plentiful, rather than fossil fuels, which are being depleted. Saving energy usually costs less than buying it, and it also moves us towards reducing pollution and reducing our carbon footprint. The project started out with a literature review of Alaska energy programs. The last time that Alaska saw really high oil prices in the 80s, when Iran and Iraq were at war, there was a lot of money that was spent on doing research about energy programs around the state, and there were some of those programs that were adopted and implemented, and some of them stuck, but some of them went the way of the dinosaur when the price of oil went down again. So we looked at those programs and did key informant interviews, talking with experts in energy policy in Alaska, getting their perspective on why the ones that stuck worked, why some of the programs didn't work, and just kind of trying to get their input there. Then we did a literature review of best practices in the United States, Canada, and other northern countries. We were assisted in that effort by the Rocky Mountain Institute, which is one of the world leaders in energy efficiency and conservation. They're based down in Colorado, but they sort of assisted us and helped guide some of our thinking on this project. Then we had an energy efficiency work session on January 16th in 2008. We got some professionals from Alaska, from the Rocky Mountain Institute, and just sat down and kind of hammered out what had been done in Alaska, what hadn't been done in Alaska, what people had been talking about, where the roadblocks were, and why things hadn't been moving forward. We then did a whole lot of data collection and data cleaning. The Alaska Energy Authority and the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation both have been collecting information and data about energy programs in Alaska for a long time. So we sort of got what we could from them and saw took what was useful. We developed some interim recommendations for sort of to put forward for adoption in the 2008 legislative session. We got extensive feedback from a large panel of energy and policy professionals in the state, and then produced final recommendations. And this is taking a little bit of a step back, but I just kind of wanted to give a little bit of background. The ACEEE is a national organization that does energy efficiency sort of program and policy evaluation and work. And they put out a report that ranks states according to these set of criteria, which are listed up there. It's based on utility spending on efficiency and conservation, efficiency standards for utilities, combined heat and power, building codes, transportation policies, appliance standards, tax incentives, and a state lead by example. Alaska ranks 41st in energy efficiency, which is not so hot. The only two kind of places where there are shining stars for Alaska, at least, are in combined heat and power. We do a fair amount of that in rural Alaska, so that's good. And we get a few points for the building codes that the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation has, even though we don't have a state building energy code. In terms of utility spending, we're dead last in terms of dollars spent, and behind only Georgia and Alabama are behind us in terms of dollars per resident spent. I think we spent 11 cents per person, and most of it was spent by Golden Valley Electric. The next four slides are just some examples of best practices that are that have been implemented in State Bill 48. It was when we were looking at best practices from other states in the United States and provinces in Canada, we did try and steer clear of only using best practices from California, knowing that those would not be the most popular ones in Alaska. You know, many of these, the first one, 39 states have building energy codes that require a minimum level of efficiency from new construction for both residential and commercial buildings. And most of those have a built-in trigger that that requires that they be updated from time to time, so they're not just set in 1970 and left there forever. But Alaska does not have that. Appliance standards, minimum efficiency standards for certain appliances, energy efficiency funding, just a committed funding stream to kind of in perpetuity pay for energy efficiency programs, outreach, education, that kind of public awareness is something that is pretty essential to the behavior change component of energy efficiency and conservation. Energy efficiency in state facilities. This is another one that is pretty widespread, and that's just building, transportation, or other energy standards set for public vehicles, buildings, and other purchases of office equipment and electronics, things like that. And this was implemented in 36 states at the time of our review. I'd be willing to bet it's been implemented in more states, and generally is sold as just sort of government being good stewards of public funds by using them more responsibly and spending less on fuel consumption. Best practices in finance and incentives. Tax incentives are used in many, many states. It's a little bit trickier in a state where there's not so very much taxes. We have our hammer is a little bit less threatening. The pay-as-you-save programs, which are pretty similar. They're similar in a lot of ways to what I forget the name of the person from Siemens who was describing, but with what the ESCOs do. I mean, they basically are a third party or a utility in many cases, has a list of efficiency measures or a list of dollar and energy saving measures that can be implemented, and then they forward you the they give you the funds to do those measures, and then as you're saving, you pay them back from what you save. And there are, it can be done at the commercial and the residential level. Is there music?
It's church.
Okay.
Clock times.
Sorry.
4 o'clock.
Okay.
That's a Juno thing.
That's a Juno thing. Okay. We don't have those in Anchorage.
No.
So there are utilities that do them with residential customers also. And usually what they do is they have a short list of, tried and true things like replacing all of your light, your incandescent bulbs with CFLs. And so they know you're going to save money on that. And then they continue to bill you the same amount every month until you've paid them back, at which point your utility bill goes down. So that's pretty painless.
Senator Wagner.
Back up just a little bit and ask you a question.
Sure.
When you you went over pretty quickly building energy codes, is it necessary to create a building energy code, or could, for instance, let's say the state wanted to set up a required list on design specifications for any state facility that state dollars go into, such as the amount of glass on the surface you could use, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's what you're calling your energy codes.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what the terminology is now? I know a lot of universities and other states have done that for years and years and years. You don't go on many state universities now and see glass buildings.
No, and we are kind of, when John talks about what makes sense right now, we're going to talk a lot about building energy codes. And there, and I mean, setting up a list of criteria that lead to a building that consumes less energy is essentially a building energy code.
Just real briefly, we have, through the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, regulations adopted what's called the Building Energy Efficiency Standards for Alaska. And they are an energy efficiency code, and they do apply to projects that AHSC finances. What we're talking about here is broadening that to not be just things that AHFC finances, but the whole state. So the approach you're talking about is right. There's two different fundamental approaches to how those codes can be constructed. One is a list of specifications, like it's called prescriptive,
right?
Like you, and the other is a performance standard. It says you need to reduce energy by X amount from what a standard is, and you use modeling tools to develop and demonstrate that you meet that. So there's, and generally both of those paths are allowed within the code.
So it's an either or if you...
You can use one or the other, whichever you prefer, right? It turns out, for example, in residential, almost everybody chooses the performance path because it gives them more flexibility.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Further questions? Yeah. Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you. The EE funding, you know, we have the weatherization rebate. Did you factor that in?
This project was underway as that occurred, and we were happy to be able to be part of that advocacy effort, but it was not in it certainly was not considered in the ACEEE ranking of Alaska, and I suspect, you know, we would have gotten some points for that, but no, it's not factored into our analysis at the time that this report was written, because it yep. came afterwards.
We were hoping to get at least an A minus on that
program. yeah for sure.
Exactly. I think on a per capita basis, we're well up the top.
Yeah, there. No, yeah, absolutely. That's very true. So other kind of finance and incentive programs that are utilized in other places, a revolving loan fund. I'm sure you're all familiar with the principle of a revolving loan fund, but here it's just capitalized for the purpose of providing upfront money for energy efficiency improvements, and then the loans are repaid and available for other users. And certainly something like a capitalized revolving loan fund for school districts or to do upgrades to their buildings or public buildings, or I mean it could be really anyone. AEA could do it for commercial buildings. Then incentives in terms of fast track for permitting, building envelope incentives, allowing agencies to keep the money saved from reducing their energy bills. Best practices in terms of utility regulation, and this is one where Alaska has had a weak regulatory environment for a long time and has very little in the way of end use management programs in any of the utilities in the state. That, and in most utilities in other parts of the world, there is an end use management component. So it's worth noting, and I think that there is interest amongst the utilities in moving in that direction. GVEA does have an end use management program. I know that there are a couple of the other railroad utilities have advisory committees that are working on trying to help get something together. But so a couple or some of the best practices are listed up there, acquisition of cost-effective energy efficiency measures, and that's just essentially the state requiring that utilities use a total resource cost test and purchase all energy efficient measures that, you know, meet the test. Aligning utility incentives equally. Often utility incentive programs don't align the utility's profits equally with supply and demand resources. So, for example, decoupling, which is something that could be implemented in South Central where we have natural gas, and would kind of take away the incentive to, or the profits that utilities see from, or some of the profits that utilities see from higher consumption, and allow consumers to actually save more by reducing their own consumption. Align ratepayers with efficiency by creating a rate structure that rewards efficiency, such as a tiered rate system with lower rates for less consumption. It's kind of just the opposite with most utilities now. Systems benefit funds, and this is a funding mechanism for energy efficiency programs that is a non-bypassable charge that shows up on your electric or your gas utility bill and is then placed into a fund that can be used for energy efficiency initiatives. GVEA does have, I would just note that GVEA, when they created their energy efficiency programs, put what is essentially a systems benefit charge onto the utility and received very, very little pushback from their consumers.
Excellent. Senator French.
I think you may have explained it in the last sentence, but a non-bypassable charge, what does that mean?
Just means you have to pay it.
As opposed to the rest of my bill?
It's not optional. Yeah. Right. Yeah. It doesn't fluctuate with your, it's just a set charge.
It's a fixed charge.
$2 a month or a dollar a month.
Okay.
And everybody pays it and goes in.
Thank you.
And often when that's brought up with utilities, they say that they don't feel like they can charge their consumers more, consumers who are already paying high utility costs. But I would just note that GVEA did have the experience of implementing the charge, explaining to their customers what the charge was and why it was being implemented, and receiving really very little pushback. Some best practices in terms of education opportunities, ongoing consumer education about energy efficiency and or renewable energy. And this is one of those cases, I think, that, I mean, most people, when they talk about behavior change, usually talk about tobacco control and just what it took to create the kind of change in the way that people thought about tobacco use. And it took consistent, dedicated funds and a pretty broad spread, wide social marketing campaign, and to have behavior change. John, you really have to have that sort of ongoing consumer.
We don't
education.
Have a donut policy. It's fresh fruit <That's> and resources.
But soon,
healthy.
Soon.
Yes.
It's fresh fruit.
Excellent. It's fresh fruit. That's we're trying to watch our
excellent
health.
Contractor, architect, engineer education, and just builder education, so that they understand new building technology, what it means to plan for the whole building and build good buildings. School curriculum, and this is just including curriculum in schools that informs students about the value of energy efficiency and conservation, and it's always difficult to add anything to school curriculum because the schools are already tasked with doing so much in such a short amount of time. But there are lesson plans, and there is curriculum that exists that is available for schools to just, you know, pick up, ready to go, and implement. So it's a little bit less work in that way from the schools.
I invite you tonight as well. Actually, most of the members of this committee are members of another Senate committee that will be meeting starting at 5:15 to talk about energy and alternative energy, its generation, its conservation, all of it in our schools, education. And so we're going to have Fran Ulmer will be here.
Yeah.
And we'll have the Commissioner of Education and of Labor and the head of AvTech to talk about what some of the current programs are and what we can do to improve them. So we we see in our body over here a lot of intersecting.
Yeah, there are some amazing opportunities in schools. It's pretty exciting. The recommendations were presented in 9 categories, state leadership, funding energy efficiency, public education and outreach, baseline data, existing residential buildings, new residential construction, existing commercial buildings, new commercial construction, and public buildings. And at the end of the presentation, there's some websites where you can link if you want a copy of the entire report and the 100-page appendices, then you can download that. The first set of recommendations was about state leadership, and our recommendations were that the governor should articulate an energy efficiency vision for Alaska. This is something that a lot of governors and mayors even have done for their municipalities, and just sort of articulating a vision and then following up with some action about, you know, what they're going to do in state buildings or with state government, and just providing leadership. The governor should designate a sub-cabinet for state end-use efficiency programs. That was a recommendation in large part because whenever the demand side gets together with the supply side gets a lot more exciting, because it's about stuff and projects, and it can create jobs, and it uses new snazzy-looking technology. And so, I mean, I am a demand-side person. I have a hard time, you know, looking away from the shiny supply-side stuff. So that was, in large part, what was driving that recommendation, is that if there's not a group of people whose sole task is looking at the end-use efficiency side of things, that... Yeah. All of the energy gets sucked into the supply side. For funding for energy efficiency, these are just 4 options for funding energy efficiency programs. The first one, the state should fund energy efficiency programs through legislative appropriation. That's our least favorite because it's, if you don't have money 1 year, like possibly this year, it would be harder to convince to get that money reappropriated. The Regulatory Commission of Alaska should implement a system benefit charge to support end-use efficiency programs. And that's the charge I was talking about that would show up on your utility bill, and it would be a dedicated and continuous funding stream, kind of like in perpetuity. The state should capitalize an end-use efficiency endowment to support end-use efficiency programs. And the state should offer matching grants to local governments interested in creating a local energy plan that incorporates, or that must incorporate, energy efficiency and conservation as part of the plan. I think from my perspective, the second one, the Regulatory Commission of Alaska implementing, requiring a system benefit charge, is makes the most sense in the long term. It probably would be the most difficult to actually implement, to make it happen. Public education and outreach. The legislature should fund a comprehensive public awareness campaign with at least $1 million a year using one of these funding mechanisms. Baseline data. One of the things that we saw when we did the data collection and data cleaning was that there is some good data, but it's pretty spotty, even along the rail belt, which was the focus. The rail belt and the Fort Ann Pool was the focus of our report. So just getting a good baseline for where we are, so that if we're spending money on programs, we can know whether or not they're working, you know, so that we can measure whether or not they're working. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the things that the Rocky Mountain Institute, definitely when they were looking at Alaska, noticed. They said, you know, you really, really need baseline data, because otherwise you could be spending money and you could think it's working, but you just don't really know.
Absolutely. And I think that becomes more important when you think about the $100 million that was appropriated by AEA for all of these new projects. And mm-hmm. some of the criticism or skepticism was, will they work? You know, and is it enough money to make it work? And so on. So I think it becomes particularly important as sort of the mission measure part of it, that you're measuring.
It gives you a metric to measure things by.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then the second sort of a specific piece of baseline data is that the Alaska Energy Authority should establish and report an energy use index. So that's gathering baseline data, but it also is advertising that baseline data, letting people know how much your public buildings, how much energy they're consuming, and in a way that it's put in some context so that folks can say this building over here uses too much energy, and or this building over here looks really good in terms of energy consumption.
Senator French.
Thanks, Madam Chair. That's a great suggestion, like the several suggestions we've gotten. And I'm just wondering, what do we need to do to make that particular suggestion happen? Do they need legislative direction? Do they need an appropriation? Does the governor just need to tell them to get to work? I mean, what's the missing link between that good idea and making it come to life?
The energy use index,
yes.
One? You know, we were talking about this earlier, and it's not really that tricky. You know, it's pretty much...
I was afraid you'd say that.
It's pretty much, you know, how much energy your building consumes to heat and light. And, mm-hmm. I mean, John was pointing out there are a few cases, like with district heating on university campus or something, where it might get kind of
complicated. Shared costs across several buildings, for example.
Yeah, so then it might be hard to say this is how much that building uses.
That's something that could be affected by an executive order.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a particularly expensive thing to do, but it does require somebody whose job it is to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Is it housed electronically? Is it sort of a website type form?
It would be a database kind of thing. You need to acquire data about, you know, the square footage of a building and what its actual energy consumption is, and then you report a number like BTUs per square foot.
Mm-hmm.
And then somebody's tasked with gathering that data,
right,
on a regular point,
right,
and then reporting it.
And it gives you an apples and apples way to compare different buildings.
And if you wanted to pick the 10 worst buildings in the state you wanted to weatherize next year, you have the list ready to go.
Exactly.
That's right.
Boom.
Exactly.
Just right. You know, you don't have to go out and gather it. It's already been done.
Right.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Existing residential buildings, well, we said that the legislature should significantly increase funding for low-income weatherization, and they did. So the second one was AHFC should create a certification and training program for energy retrofit and energy-efficient new construction. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation should subsidize up to 100% of costs for home energy audits for households not eligible for low-income weatherization and offer low-interest loans for energy conservation improvements. And this was, of course, before the home energy rebate program was funded by the legislature last session, which essentially does that, except they're grants, not loans, or rebates.
Can I ask?
There are also loans, actually.
But there are also loans,
too.
Yeah.
Why did you pick HFC as the entity, the governmental entity, that should create certification and training programs?
I think that we chose for the energy retrofit and energy efficiency construction because they house the most expertise.
They already have a program in training energy raters, for
okay,
example, and it was expanding that program.
Got it. Thank you.
And then the legislature should fund a pilot smart meter program through Alaska Housing Finance Corporation and Alaska Energy Authority. Smart meters are very popular with some people, and then other people are very skeptical of them. They are good. There are good, cheaper units now that can be put into homes that that do appear to change people's behavior in a way that they reduce their energy consumption. In the province of Ontario, the government bought a smart meter for every single household to reduce their energy, which was a big, I mean, there are a lot of people in Ontario, so it was a big outlay initially, but they think that they'll recoup those costs through delaying new infrastructure development.
Does it yell at you when you leave the lights
right
on?
No, they just simply,
that's the next
kind
version,
of provide you information about how much. It's like having your meter that's usually on the outside of your house or on a pole someplace else in your kitchen so you can see it. It
mm-hmm.
just provides.
It
turns out that having that immediate feedback causes people to change their behavior,
sure,
to the extent that they often save somewhere between 5% and 10% of their energy costs. So it's a
sort of like you get your electricity bill, and that next week,
yeah,
you're pretty
you
focused
get your electricity
on it
bill every day.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
There's actually another flavor of that too, which has to do with whether the utilities have time of day rates,
mm-hmm.
and some of the smart meter programs have to do with helping people decide when to do their laundry, for example, and that kind of thing. And most of our utilities don't do that now, but at some point in the future, it would probably make sense for them to start considering that.
Wow.
New residential construction, we recommended that the legislature should adopt BEES, which is the Building Energy Efficiency Standard that Alaska Housing Finance Corporation has, as the new state residential energy efficiency building code, or the energy building code for the state, and that the State Division of Corporations, Businesses, and Professional Licensing should enforce regulations on building codes and contractor licensing to ensure quality and energy efficiency. Sort of, I mean, those two are obviously related. We think that there should be a building energy code and that there should be people to ensure that it is enforced.
Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And my understanding is that Alaska is slated to get, I think about $28 million, $30 million in the federal stimulus package. But one of the requirements is that you have to have a state building code.
Mm-hmm. You have to have assurances that you will have one.
And most states already do, 39.
For existing commercial buildings, we recommended that the Alaska Energy Authority should subsidize energy audits for commercial facilities and offer loans for energy efficiency improvements. They're just, I mean, commercial facilities have huge square footage and are often built on blueprints developed in California at corporate headquarters and are not, or shouldn't be built in our northern climates and are huge wasters of energy. The Regulatory Commission of Alaska should require utilities to implement pay-as-you-save loan programs for commercial buildings. That was the second recommendation. For new commercial construction, we recommended that the AEA should contract for a stakeholder process to develop a commercial energy efficiency energy building code, of which there is not one in Alaska. For public buildings, the recommendations some of this is outdated already, but we recommended that the governor should direct each state agency to reduce energy consumption in its facilities by 20% from 2000 levels by 2020. The Board of Regents should direct the university to reduce energy consumption in its facilities, same amount, same time frame. The legislature should fund an energy audit for every school in the state. The state should fund AEA to revive the institutional conservation program to offer public K-12 school energy conservation matching grants, which is a program that AEA used to run and went unfunded, so kind of fell away, but was a good program.
Are there federal dollars associated with that?
No. The Alaska Energy Authority should establish a low-interest loan program for public facilities to make energy efficiency improvements with payments geared to projected savings, which is essentially kind of that pay-as-you-save idea again.
Can we go back to that, mm-hmm. last one? Yeah. But recommendation three, for example, could be something that we could fund with some of the stimulus money through the energy programs if we chose to.
Mm-hmm. Sort of where we are today, weatherization received $200 million. That's all right. The home energy rebate program, which hopefully you all are familiar with, was funded at $160 million.
Renewable energy. That was just passed last night.
John put something new in my slide. Renewable energy, $100 million. There's a fair amount of market-driven conservation already occurring in rural Alaska. Rural Alaskans use far less energy per household than urban Alaskans do. And have for a long time. There's a broad and growing awareness of energy issues and how they affect our economic lives, our household economics, our environment, our place in the world's political scene. There just is a growing awareness and of energy issues and of their importance. And just also, you know, a note that supply-side solutions continue to dominate. They continue to dominate discussion and our personal energy and our political will seems to continue to be dominated by supply side solutions, which are important, but not the only thing. And so now I'm going to kind of, and then the stimulus bill has been signed, which John will talk about more when he talks about kind of what makes sense now going forward what are some low and no cost initiatives that we could kind of pull out of this report and get some and do some energy savings in Alaska.
It's interesting, just briefly, the point that you make about the supply side being more interesting, and it's true, and it's just even in the word conserve and the idea of saving and bringing in is always less interesting to people than expanding and spending, and the term that I continue to hear is negawatts, which even kind of has that negative sort of, so I think you're right that, I mean, by simply not expending that kilowatt hour of energy, that's the best thing you can do. But we tend to talk about all the solutions to it. And so this is exciting.
There is still a kind of a broad perspective that efficiency and conservation means that you have to change your life a lot, that you have to be chilly in your home, or, you know, your clothes won't get as clean or something like that. But with new technology and by building homes correctly, we can still have our homes at 70 degrees and use far less fuel to get them there and keep them there.
Yeah, and it's for new construction to get there is relatively straightforward, but it is often complicated and sometimes messy business to do the retrofit, and so that's another reason why it's hard to, and that's one of the reasons why in constructing the energy rebate program that we centered it around having energy raters come evaluate, because every home is different, every circumstance is different. So so conservation is the cheapest, it's the thing we should do, and we should design it in up front, but it is less shiny and spectacular. It's hard to point at your lower energy bill, you know, or the insulation in your wall.
And then you've spurred just one more question. I've had a number of constituents that have signed up for the weatherization and to have their homes inspected, and they're on a list, and it's taking months. And so my question is, you know, and you with your university connections, are there efforts out there to recruit more of the individuals that are trained in the expertise of auditing, doing these energy audits and recommendations? We don't have enough, it seems.
Well, there's a debate about that.
Okay.
About how we've achieved a kind of equilibrium in terms of the numbers of new people coming on the list and the numbers that are getting service. So I think that we had a kind of initial panic circumstance where it appeared that the lists were long, and actually some of them, because people were on multiple lists, it actually looked worse than it was. And I think that now we're getting at a stage where maybe we could use a few more raters, but not very many. I think that we've got enough people to keep up with the demand. So we always need to look at that, but my sense right now is that we're in a pretty good equilibrium of, you know, numbers of people coming on the list and numbers of people getting served. And actually, Information Insights is also handling one of those things. So
yeah,
Katie actually knows about that on a daily basis.
I can say, and I talk to all of the energy raters in the state on a regular basis, that, and they have been training new ones, get certified nearly every week. I think that we have as many raters as we need. Certainly Anchorage, because of its population size and because there were fewer folks sort of interested in becoming raters initially in Anchorage, because there was less awareness of weatherization and stuff like that. Not like in Fairbanks, where people had had more awareness of that because it's a colder climate, and their utility costs are higher. So, and there were also more job opportunities in Anchorage. So Anchorage, even though it had the biggest population, had not very many raters. Mm-hmm. So
on that point, just an idea I thought of, and it just is that, you know, with the downturn in the economy, and we have arguably not been affected as much, but you have mortgage or home appraisers, if you will, that come out, and it strikes me there aren't as many appraisals going on. People aren't buying and selling their homes the way that they were in our expanding economy in the last 4 years, that perhaps some of those individuals might be retrained, and it might be an opportunity to reduce unemployment in that area.
I think that where there's a real opportunity is in people actually doing the work. I think that in terms of the ratings, we have the workforce that we need to get the job done. And unless the legislature appropriates another couple hundred million dollars and we sign up, you know, 25,000 more houses or something like that. But right now, we do pretty much have it handled. We have it. you know, we're beginning to see more people coming off the list than signing up on the list, and so we're working through it. But I think that people are really going to begin to feel the crunch of finding a contractor who knows how to do energy retrofits, and that's an opportunity for people who are looking for work when there's not as much new construction happening, for sure. Yeah.
And there are some new construction contractors who are beginning to do more of this sort of retrofit work now. So it's I think it is a good opportunity.
New jobs, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's great.
So let me just quickly sort of summarize kind of some of the things where we are. I wanted to talk about sort of four things that I wanted to emphasize out of this package. And to reiterate what Katie said, if you go to the CCHRC website, which is Cold Climate Housing Research Center, cchrc.org, you can download this whole report there, among other places. So if you want all the details, it's available. And also this presentation that we did is available through Senator Bilikoski's office. He has the full PowerPoint presentation. But the four areas I want to talk about is the building code issue, the public building energy standards, and then I'm going to deviate a little bit from energy efficiency and get into the supply side a little bit, because I just can't resist doing that, because they relate in two areas, the need for research and development on renewables what we think is necessary is a sort of a statewide emphasis on making all of our communities more sustainable. And so energy efficiency is an important component of that, but renewable energy is also a fits in with that picture too. So with your leave, I want to broaden the discussion just a tad that way here. So the first issue is statewide building code, and we've talked about that quite a bit already. When we had our expert meeting in Anchorage in the course of developing this set of recommendations, that we had one of those dot exercises where we put all the things up on the wall and everybody chose the one. It built by a long measure, the building code was the number one recommendation out of that group of people. It was really felt that was, if you could do one thing, that was the single most important thing that we could do to begin to, you know, it provides a lot of things. It provides some education, it provides some necessary training, but it also provides a kind of a floor that we're not going to go below, so we're not creating problems that we need to retrofit in the future, you know, that we're, yeah, as we go in forward, we're building buildings that meet a reasonable standard. And of course there's a lot of debate about that, and there has been, whether we, you know, we're the last frontier and whether you want to regulate people that much. But if we're going to start providing hundreds of millions of dollars to help people retrofit, then I think there's a public interest in making sure that we don't go too low. And then there's other, of course, things like pollution issues and like greenhouse gas emissions and things like that are related to that as well as energy efficiency. We looked at the amount of money we're spending in Fairbanks on energy annually. It's north of $450 million a year. That's a large amount of money. If you could cut and buildings use 40% of the total energy, if we could cut that in half, that's 20% of that $400 or $500 million a year. Just think of having that money stay in your economy and circulate instead of just going outside somewhere else. So it's when you look at it in the aggregate, it's a big deal. And I think when we look forward, we're going to have to start doing these kinds of things, or we just simply are not going to be sustainable.
Senator Wagner,
a couple other. Oh, I'm sorry. What's the question?
Yeah. Well, we don't want to just, and I don't think this committee is going to take on the task of adopting a statewide building code with energy conservation codes. I think you were here long enough to know the intricacies of trying to just come up with one building code and who's going to enforce it and who's going to be the agency that has control of it and everything else. I got my bumps off of that, and I know so did Senator Terrio and some others.
And Senator McGuire.
You were on the House side of that. I guess is what I would ask you is what you're really looking for is more of a subcode to become a part of a statewide building code, then, right?
We're really emphasizing the energy
portion of it.
Right, right.
And I guess if somebody's going to take that on as a project, I would recommend they do it outside of the building code and then have it as an attachment too eventually.
And that's exactly the approach that we took when we, CCHRC was tasked with helping HFC revise the building energy efficiency standard. And when we took that on a couple years ago, what we did is we recast it in terms of the International Energy Conservation Code, so that the terms of it are code-like, and so that if in the future you wanted to make that part of it building code, it would just, it'd be in the right terminology, it could slip right in there. So yeah, you're exactly right. That's okay. The approach to take. But there are a couple facts I wanted to put up here, and one is that HFC for a while has seen the need to have a more level playing field, and this has to do in a couple different areas, but the most important one is that when a homeowner goes to decide to finance their house, they can use an HFC loan and get a small reduction in their mortgage rate, or they can go to a financing package that's available through Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. And the difference there is that if you go through the federal programs, they don't require meeting any particular building energy efficiency. Now, that may change at the federal level, but it hasn't yet. But that creates an uneven playing field, so that when you move forward and you're trying to finance a house, if you have an energy efficiency requirement on one hand, you don't on the other, a lot of people just don't want to bother with the paperwork, even though it's going to get them a lower mortgage rate. So there's some issues there that are about leveling the playing field, and that's why a number of people that have worried about how the Alaska Housing Finance operates have been supporting this over the years. The other sort of new thing is that just within, I believe it's in the last month, that the Alaska State Home Builders Association has passed a resolution supporting the adoption of a statewide energy conservation code. And so one of the major constituencies out there that has been resistant in the past, frankly, to doing this is now on board. So that's a big change out there politically. The reason why they've done that is that they went through the exercise themselves of trying to put in place a volunteer code. They saw the need for it. They didn't want to be forced into it by state regulation, and they thought that maybe they could do it on the private sector side. Over the course, they've made a really great effort over the last 2 years to do that, and they found that they just can't get there. And so that's why I think that they've sort of changed their tune, and they're now supporting. So that's another change. The last change that I've mentioned up here is that actually having us be on track to adopt some kind of statewide energy conservation code is required by the stimulus bill if we're going to be able to receive certain parts of the money, in particular the state energy program grants. And that's for the weatherization and the rebate type program work. So, and there's something, as Senator Wilikowski mentioned earlier, it's about $28 million that where having this in place is required. And there may be other places that are where it's required too, but in here specifically. So there's a couple things that are out there now that are new.
Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think one of the concerns that I had with this was the additional costs that might be incurred to people building homes. And I'm glad to see the home builders are on board on this. I think that's a huge development. But you and I talked a little bit before this about additional costs, and you didn't seem to think there would be a huge amount, or really very much at all, in increased costs that would be presented. Can you explain that?
Yeah, it turns out that if you start off your process to design an energy efficient home, there are trade-offs that you can have in the amount of insulation you put in versus the size of the heating and ventilation system, for example. And so you can spend more on insulation, spend less on your heating and ventilation system, and that those kind of trade-offs can just about net out. Maybe you might spend a little bit more, but not much. And we're not talking here at all about the life cycle savings. Oftentimes when you spend a little bit more on insulation, for example, you can expect to get that paid back fairly quickly. In saving your energy bills. I'm just talking about the initial capital cost. There have been a number of studies about green building, where people think that they're really expensive. If you try to add energy efficiency or green building at the end of a project, it's more expensive. But if you program it in for the beginning, it's not very much more expensive. And it certainly, to the extent that it is, it's paid back by your energy savings easily. So it's not as expensive as people think. It doesn't have to be. I'll give you an example of it. There's the biggest builder in Fairbanks is now building all green buildings and all five-star plus, and they're all at affordable, you know, $175,000 sort of houses. So he's able to be at the midpoint or even slightly lower than the midpoint of the price point in the market there in Fairbanks and construct really good houses. So it doesn't have to be more expensive.
Can I ask you a question too? On the building code itself, you've got mechanical codes and plumbing codes and things that come under there as subsets. Are there recommendations for those categories as well?
Well, those would be, we're really recommending, and what we would like to see is a statewide building code, which includes those. The issues, though, there's a lot of devils in the detail about how you do the inspections for those, and I have some ideas about how to do that, but we, you know, it's going to need a lot of, you know, there's issues about how you implement this in rural Alaska versus urban Alaska, and there's and there are different ways to do it, and I think that there are ways that we could do it that would be where we would rely on the inspections that most banks require already. Most banks require what's called an ICBO inspection, which means that you do that kind of, you inspect for electrical and you inspect for mechanical systems, you inspect for the insulation before you close up. There are some inspections. If you just added a little bit more to the task of those inspectors and train them, the additional work would not be that much more. My kind of pulling it out of the air estimate is it might cost another $300 on the inspection costs for homes for new construction. So that sort of it's a little bit more, but it's not. And I think that if you did that through the private sector, through the kind of requirements that banks are already making, you wouldn't need to create a large state bureaucracy to do that.
Okay.
So there are, I mean, you can do it, you know, you can do the full-blown inspector, you know, thing, but you can also do it, state program thing. But I think there are ways to do it that are much more cost-effective.
And then last thing, too, we still have a lot of Alaskans that build their own homes,
mm-hmm.
and either with their own hands or the hands of their neighbors or subcontracting out. And so how would we... would there be how to do it kits or, you know?
There's a variety of training that we can do. I mean, there already is some training for people who want to do it themselves, but to do it correctly. I mean, I built my own house, and I didn't build it all myself, but I availed myself of that training,
yeah.
And so that's available to people right now. We think that, I mean, what we would advocate is that we don't apply this to people who are self-financing. The only caveat is that people need to understand that if they build their own home and they self-finance it, if at some point in the future they want to sell it where there is bank financing involved, they may have an issue about getting the appropriate certifications from the bank for the bank in order to sell it. But other than that, we wouldn't advocate that. A person building, you know, from paycheck to paycheck would have to be subject to that.
Probably be important, like just thinking of Alaskans and our spirit, you know.
I think the right way to go there is training as opposed to regulation. Anyway, those are the some new issues that I wanted to bring to your attention with respect to building code. I'll try to wrap this up fairly fast. The state energy program grant requirements, and this comes out of the stimulus bill, requires that the governor send a letter to the Secretary of Energy that certifies three broad things. One is that it gives assurances that we have a program that where the utilities are supporting consumer energy efficiency policies. Now, this would be the kind of thing that Katie was talking about earlier with the systems benefit charge. So they have some kind of programs in place funded somehow that are like the GEA programs that provide consumer education as to how they can save energy. So that would be, that's one broad area. The other broad area is this one we've just been talking about, which is building codes, and it stipulates both residential and commercial. So that's a significant issue there. There are model codes for commercial, which aren't much different than the residential approach. They have some different performance standards and things like that, but there are codes available that are fairly straightforward. And then the last one, which is probably the easiest of the three, is just that the state needs to certify that they will make every attempt to prioritize these grants as they go out into whatever the state program is towards energy efficiency or renewable energy programs wherever possible. So there's those three areas of assurance that the governor needs to do in order for us to be eligible to receive the money from the stimulus package for these programs. The last thing I'd like to suggest to you is that we consider a broad statewide program that might be called Sustainable Northern Communities. You can name it whatever you want, but the point is that most of our communities, even our larger communities, Fairbanks and Anchorage included, are not sustainable. Yes. The way we're spending money and the way we're designing buildings right now. And the way forward in this is to look at a kind of vision where we use our oil wealth that we have now as a transition to an economy that's based on renewable energy, and that we have to make that decision. We've made some steps. I mean, like the bill that was passed related to renewable energy was a step in that direction. The energy rebate program and the weatherization programs are already steps that we've taken that are in the direction of doing this kind of thing. But I think that we need to enunciate that as our state vision, that we need to try to get there. And the governor has also put one step forward in that as a vision. But it's going to take an enormous effort for us to get there within, in my view, within 30 years or something like that, that we are going to have to really focus and focus clearly on that goal of transitioning to renewable energy. I mentioned it sort of indirectly, when we look at how we do this process, we need to use what's called in the design area, integrated design process. And this is this idea of coordinating the design. So when we go into a village, for example, we need to not only talk about energy efficiency and the supply side, but we need to do that at the same time. And we need to involve all the stakeholders at the beginning of the process. And when you do that, you can achieve synergies that you can't achieve otherwise if you don't coordinate this sort of effort. So this, both Alaska Energy Authority and AHFC in the past have talked about this sort of approach. They called it a few years ago the whole village retrofit, for example. And that's kind of what they had in mind, was planning energy efficiency and the supply side at the same time. The last thought I would add is that we tend to talk a lot about energy, and we separate that out from agriculture. And I wanted to add this last bullet so that we don't forget that, that when we're planning sustainable communities, we also have to worry a lot about food security. And I've seen estimates that in Fairbanks, for example, that we have 3 days worth of food in town. You know, if you could imagine the supply line got shut off, we'd be concerned fairly quickly. And so we need to start thinking in a broader sense in the state of Alaska how we're going to feed ourselves and not rely so much on strawberries coming in from Peru or someplace like that. And so part of that, and when you're planning energy plans, is to look at, for example, the use of greenhouses and making use of the last bit of waste heat, quote unquote, to produce crops. We can produce lettuce and tomatoes and things like that with this energy that we're wasting now, if we were to coordinate that. And I think that's going to be especially important in rural Alaska when we start looking at villages and providing plans for those villages to be sustainable. But I think it applies just as much in Fairbanks and probably Anchorage as it does in villages that, you know, if you really think about it, what we're doing now is not sustainable. And so we're going to have to have a significant plan to move forward. And the umbrella that I'd like to offer is that we talk about sustainable northern communities, and I mean all of our communities in the state of Alaska. So the last slide gives you the contact information. Polk Climate Housing Research Center facilitated this study. Information Insights carried out, did most of the work. Katie actually did most of the actual writing, so she's the real expert on this. But the funding came from Alaska Housing Finance Corporation and the Alaska Energy Authority.
I want to, on behalf of our committee, thank you for your work, and thank you too, Katie. And we have, through various strains of presentations and conversations, the members of this committee have talked about most of the things that you've brought today, but to have it all bundled like this is really informative. And I know I, for one, I've shared with people when I had an opportunity to go to Iceland this fall, and it was exactly this concept of a sustainable community that they have developed, and it came out of the oil shocks in the early 70s, and they immediately made the link between energy sustainability and food sustainability and their hydroponic vegetable greenhouses and so on. And I think the next 50 years of Alaska, if you think about it, the idea that we could decide for ourselves what we want our life to look like, what we want our communities to look like. And so much in particular of rural Alaska feels like through evolution and time, it's what happens to them. Mm-hmm. And they have to adapt around and adjust and so on. But it isn't about sitting down as a community and deciding what do we want it to look like? You know, where does the energy come from? How do we sustain our culture and our way of life and our food sources? And so it's exciting from the energy part of it, but from the social part of it. Mm-hmm. And I think there are tremendous opportunities that spring from that, and just that security that the people in Iceland, and granted, they've had tremendous things happen to their country outside of that, but there is a sense there that, you know, in the pyramid, that they've got the energy and the food that they need, you know, mm-hmm. to keep going. So it's exciting. Thank you for your work. And Shalon mentioned to me that all of our resources, PowerPoints and documents and things, she and Michelle put on the basis.
Okay, great.
So if anybody out there wants to access the presentation from today, they can.
Madam
Chair.
Anything
else? Yes, Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you. One question. Very good, Katie and John. The I'm not sure what the right term is, but some of us were visiting Fairbanks back a month or so ago, and I'll call it the Anituvik mm-hmm. prototype. Mm-hmm. Would you give us about a 30-second burst on Anituvik prototype?
I was thinking about that. we have a program that we call Sustainable Northern Shelter, as opposed to Northern Communities, which is focused on providing housing in northern areas. And we, and this is the idea that, you know, trying to get away from the idea of doing it to villages and trying to involve villages in the design, and it's also trying to involve this idea of integrated design process and what in architecture they call design charrettes, where you bring everybody together and brainstorm mm-hmm. things. And so we applied that approach in a particular case in Anituvik Pass, where the North Slope Borough asked us to help them design a new house. They hadn't built a new residence there in 10 years. And the reason was that the last quote they got was $750,000 to build one house. And they just didn't have that much money. And so we set ourselves the design goal to build a house for about $125,000 to $150,000, in which we could put all the materials for it in one DC-3 flight. They just built a senior comp, 5-person senior complex there. I think it took something like 40 Herc loads to get all the material in for that, because, you know, there's no roads, there's no barges that go into Anituvik. It's, you know, up in the passes there. So the first thing we did, though, was we had some ideas about how to do that. But the first thing we did is we went to the village and had a 2-day design charrette where we involved. And over half the village participated in these 2-day discussions about what they wanted their housing to look like. And so there's a lot of buy-in on what this, you know, and we learned a lot about what they thought was important. And, you know, things like, you know, being able to repair your snow machine, being able to skin out your caribou, you know, although, you know, there are pieces of housing that, you know, if you live in Fairbanks or Anchorage, you might not think about as being particularly important as part of the housing issue, but it's very important to them. The way kitchens were designed was another issue that came up, that, you know, the sort of almost potlatch kind of approach to village life, living, that was important, that kitchens were too constraining, you know, the way they were traditionally designed. So we took all those things, did a design that we thought, and then went back and had another charrette with the villagers and said, here's what we, you know, and got another set of. So it's that sort of integrated design approach where you bring everybody to the table at the beginning, and then you bring in the same, you do the same approach with all your contractors, the subs, the electricians, how you're going to provide heat, and you do that whole thing. And we're in the process of doing that. We haven't actually, we hope to build this place this spring, or this summer, early summer. But we, over this winter, we've been testing some of the ideas that we had in a test hut there in Fairbanks and evaluating some of the technological techniques that we want to use. But we think that that's an approach that can be generalized around the state, and we've been actually asked by a number of other villages to help them with different issues, you know, designing a community building or some, you know, using that same approach to do other design processes. So I think that that's, and then in the end, what's going to happen is when this house gets built, it's going to be built with local labor. I mean, it's going to be kind of like a barn raising. So it's not going to be a force account. It's not going to be contractors come in. It's going to be y'all come and help, let's build this place. So again, I think that's the kind of way that we need to start thinking about how we're going to help ourselves be sustainable here.
Yeah, and there's a lot of pride that comes from,
absolutely,
you know, building a structure in your community and the respect that you have for it. And also, I think, observing people in your community be productive and in that process of building something together. It's great. We need to go see it.
Yeah.
Okay, anything further? Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're adjourned.
You.